If you would be so kind as to enter our confidence, Gascoigne added, from Balfour's other side, in a rather nasty show of false politeness. The dark-haired man sat forward in his chair suddenly and added, "Does any man present wish to voice his reservations?" Moody looked around him, blinking, but nobody spoke. Balfour nodded. He waited a moment more, as if to append his own courtesy to that of the other, and then resumed. "Let me tell you at once," he said to Moody, "that a man has been murdered. That blackguard of yours, Carver, I mean, I shan't call him Captain, he is the murderer, though I'll be damned if I could tell you how or why. I just know it, as sure as I see that glass in your hand. Now, if you do me the honour of hearing a piece of that villain's history, then you might, well, you might be willing to help us, placed as you are."
"Excuse me, sir," Moody said. At the mention of murder, his heart had begun to beat very fast. Perhaps this had something to do with the phantom aboard the Godspeed after all.
"How am I placed?"
"With your trunk still aboard the bark, is what he means," the dark-haired man said. "And your appointment at the Custom House tomorrow afternoon." Balfour looked faintly annoyed. He waved his hand.
Let us talk of that in a moment," he said. "I entreat you first to hear the story out."
"Certainly I will listen," Moody returned, with the slightest emphasis on the last word, as though to caution the other man against expecting or demanding anything more. He thought he saw a smirk pass over Gascoigne's pale face, but in the next moment the man's features had soured again.
Of course," Balfour said, taking the point.
He put down his brandy glass, laced his knuckles together, and cracked them smartly.
"Well then, I shall endeavour to acquaint you, Mr. Moody, with the cause of our assembly."
Jupiter in Sagittarius, in which the merits of asylum are discussed, a family name comes into question, Alistair Lauderback is discomfited, and the shipping agent tells a lie. Balfour's narrative, made somewhat circuitous by interruption, and generally encumbered by the lyrical style of that man's speech, became severely muddled in the telling, and several hours passed before Moody finally understood with clarity the order of events that had precipitated the secret council in the hotel smoking room. The interruptions were too tiresome, and Balfour's approach too digressive to deserve a full and faithful record in the men's own words. We shall here excise their imperfections, and impose a regimental order upon the impatient chronicle of the shipping agent's roving mind. We shall apply our own mortar to the cracks and chinks of earthly recollection, and resurrect as new the edifice that, in solitary memory, exists only as a ruin. We begin, as Balfour himself began, with an encounter that had taken place in Hokitika that very morning. Prior to the dawn of the West Coast rush, when Hokitika was no more than a brown mouth open to the ocean, and the gold on her beaches shone quiet and unseen, Thomas Balfour lived in the province of Otago, and conducted his business from a small shingle-roofed building on the Dunedin harbour front, under a calico banner that bore the legend Balfour and Harnett Shipping Agents. Mr. Harnett had since abandoned the joint venture, of which he had owned only a one-third share. He was now enjoying a colonial retirement in Auckland, far from the Otago frost and the fog that pooled white in the valleys in the chilly hours before the dawn. The firm's advantageous location, they were squared with the central wharf and enjoyed a view towards the distant heads of the harbour, brought distinguished custom, and among their many clients was the erstwhile superintendent of Canterbury, a spade-handed giant of a man whose reputation was one of conviction, expansion, and zeal. Alistair Lauderback, this was the statesman's name, had enjoyed a sense of constant acceleration over the course of his career. He was born in London, and had trained as a lawyer before making the voyage to New Zealand in the year of 1851, setting sail with two goals. Firstly, to make his fortune, and secondly, to double it. His ambition was well suited to a political life, and especially to the political life of a young country. Lauderback rose, and rose quickly. In legal circles he was much admired as a man who could set his mind to a task and not rest until he had seen the project through. On the strength of this fine character, he was rewarded with a place on the Canterbury Provincial Council, and invited to run for the superintendency, to which post he was elected by a landslide majority vote. 5 years after his first landing in New Zealand, the network of his connection reached as far as the Stafford Ministry and the Premier himself. By the time he first knocked upon Thomas Balfour's door, wearing a fresh kofi flower in his buttonhole and a standing collar whose flared points, Balfour noticed, had been starched by a woman's hand, he could no longer be called a pioneer. He smacked of permanence, of the kind of influence that lasts. In his countenance and bearing, Lauderback was less handsome than imposing. His beard, large and blunt like Balfour's own, protruded almost horizontally from his jaw, giving his face a regal aspect. Beneath his brow, his dark eyes glittered. He was very tall, and his body tapered, which made him seem even taller still. He spoke loudly, declaring his ambitions and opinions with a frankness that might be called hubristic, if one was sceptical, or dauntless, if one was not. His hearing was slightly defective, and for this reason he tended to bow his head and stoop slightly when he was listening, creating the impression, so useful in politics, that his attentions were always gravely and providentially bestowed. In their first meeting, Lauderback impressed Balfour with the energy and confidence with which he spoke. His enthusiasms, as he announced to Balfour, did not pertain wholly to the political sphere. He was also a shipowner, having cherished since boyhood a passionate love for the sea. He possessed 4 ships in total, 2 clipper ships, a schooner, and a bark. 2 of the crafts required masters. Hitherto he had leased them on charter, but the personal risk of such a venture was high, and he desired to lease the ships instead to an established shipping firm that could afford a reasonable rate of insurance. He listed the names of the ships in rote order, as a man lists his children: the clippers Virtue and Corona Australis, the schooner Lady of the Ballroom, and the bark Godspeed. As it happened, Balfour and Harnett were sorely in need of a clipper ship at that time, of the very dimensions and capabilities that Lauderback described. Balfour had no use for the other ship on offer, the bark Godspeed, as that craft was too small for his purposes. But the Virtue, pending inspection and trial, would make the monthly passage between Port Chalmers and Port Phillip very comfortably. Yes, he told Lauderback, he would find a master for the Virtue. He would purchase insurance at a fair premium,